At the time of publication in 1992, our next guest's book, Diana, her true story in her own words, certainly caused a bit of a ruckus in the United Kingdom. Andrew Morton, I'm delighted to say, joins us on the show now. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. Nice to speak to you again.
Yes, we spoke originally back when the book first came out. Just shows how long we've both been doing this game, eh? That's a worry, isn't it?
And you still don't look a day over 80.
Now, I mentioned there that there was a big ruckus on this book, and I'm probably understating that a bit. I think I remember at the time that there was one member of Parliament who wanted you put in the Tower of London for treason, didn't they?
Absolutely. I'm just standing in my study in London, and all along one wall was a whole load of cartoons from the newspapers of the time. And the one that had my daughters in tears was the Queen was standing there in the Tower of London, and the executioner was torturing me, and the Queen saying, "Well, Mr. Morton won't be writing any more books." And, my daughters thought she was going to send me to the Tower. So,
bless.
Anyway, but yeah, it was pretty heavy going for the simple reason that I couldn't say that Diana was behind the book, which, of course, I did reveal after she died in 1997.
Yes, absolutely. And people have basically thought you were just making up salacious stories about her.
Yeah, I mean, I wish. The irony is, when she said to me, "Do you want an interview?" You know, which was...
Let me think about that for one microsecond.
Which was kind of astonishing in the first place. I thought, she'd be saying, talking about love of charity work and humanitarian mission and what she proposes to do for the next few years and how, you know, that kind of thing, which, you know, Buckingham Palace would have expected her to say.
Sure.
And what did I get? I put on a pair of headphones in this cafe, and I'll remember it like it was yesterday, in North London, and all around me, all these guys in overalls sort of eating their bacon and eggs, and they just, you know, reading the Sun newspaper and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I listened as Diana poured her heart out about her eating disorder, this bulimia nervosa, never heard of it before.
Yeah.
This woman called Camilla, and these kind of half-hearted suicide attempts. It was just like, it was literally like entering another world.
I bet.
And I went back home thinking I'd been given this big secret, and, you know, would I be... Well, it's almost like the Watergate guys... Woodward and Bernstein, and you feel that kind of sense of, you're enveloped by a sense of paranoia, and it was the start of a great adventure, which obviously was ended up in the book Diana, Her True Story.
Yeah, and now the interviews themselves, the tapes, you've now kind of released transcripts of the tapes rather than your kind of book version of it, and the tapes wasn't you walking into Diana's home with a tape recorder and stick the microphone on the table and start asking a question. It had to be a little more surreptitious than that, didn't it?
It did. It had to be secret. I mean, I'm 6'4". I was well known as a royal writer, so I couldn't wander up Kensington Palace and say, "Good morning, Prince Charles. How are you doing? Is Diana in?" Plonk myself down, have a cup of coffee. I had to use an intermediary, a chap called James Colthurst, who was a doctor and a great friend of hers and a friend of mine.
Mm.
And he agreed to go to Kensington Palace and ask the questions that I prepared. So he would toddle up there on his push bike, sit down, munch his way through a plate of biscuits, and just read out the questions. It was very much dependent on Diana's moods. If she was in a good mood, if her energy level was high, and it was, you know, usually in the morning, she would really recount an awful lot about her life. But if it was the afternoon, it was kind of a yes-no interlude.
Yeah. How many meetings did it take to get enough for the book, then?
Well, there's a bit of a misnomer about the idea that the tapes were the book. They weren't. They were basically the starting point for the book. And I interviewed a lot of her friends and her brother about her childhood, her school days, and so on. And that helped to really give a feeling for Diana as a person, apart from Diana describing herself, you know, and her life. So I had a kind of a distance there with her friends talking. And more than that, Diana was also on the telephone to James all the time, like every day, 2 or 3 hours, and I'd often be with James. So, you know, you really built up a sense of what was going on in this year, 1991, 92, and you really got a sense of her personality, her fears, her worries, and you know, you'd be dealing with media firestorms. I mean, you know, at one point I started helping her write the speeches that she was delivering.
Good grief.
So it was a lot more than just being a kind of a biographer. You're
yeah.
almost part of a secret court, almost.
Yes.
It was a rare privilege and unique. And of course, once the book came out, I expected her to myself that I would predecease her and I would just be keeping quiet about it for the rest of my life.
Of course.
Obviously, you know, we all know about the tragedy in Paris.
Yeah, 5 years after the book was published. You mentioned the phone calls there with James and yourself and Diana. Those phone calls, I believe, would be scrambled, right?
Yeah, she was absolutely paranoid about everything to do with Buckingham Palace, Kensington Palace, the police and so on. And she had a shredder in her office. Everything was shredded because people went through her mail and so on. And we used a scrambler telephone so that her calls could be encoded. And also she had her sitting room swept for bugs, which irritated the Metropolitan Police bodyguard no end. But she just didn't trust anybody. And I'll tell you why. You know, for all of her adult life, she suspected that Prince Charles was in love with another woman, with Camilla Parker Bowles. And everybody was saying to her, from the Queen Mother downwards, don't be such a silly girl, they're just friends. Mm. And of course, she realised, she knew what the reality was, and she was being told by the valet and the chef and the bodyguard and the courtiers and the officials that that there was nothing there, they were just friends. But that it was just a gigantic kind of Kafkaesque conspiracy. And she knew the reality.
Good grief. I get the impression in having read the book many times and hearing you interviewed, apart from my own interview with you, that she was almost like a prisoner who had a few moments before the guards turned up to kind of spew the stuff out.
That's a brilliant way of putting it. She did feel like a prisoner in the palace. It was, and I felt like a white knight going to battle on her behalf, because you know you could feel the pain and the frustration and the despair, but also this woman who had been out of control for a lot of her life was now feeling very much more in control. She was in control of her eating disorders. She was in control of her royal life. So I wasn't dealing with Diana when she was kind of in the dark ages. I was dealing with Diana when she was on the up, when she was, no longer a victim. She's more of a victor.
Yeah. Did at any point it cross your mind that she may have been making it up?
Well, the lawyer did. The lawyer said, you can't write that Prince Charles had an affair with Camilla Parker Bowles. You weren't in the bedroom, so you can't say that. And when I told Diana this, she was furious, absolutely livid, and she obtained, I don't know how she did it, some letters and postcards that Camilla had sent to Charles, and the contents were very loving and adoring and left nobody in any doubt that Camilla was deeply in love with Charles. And it really confirmed for Diana, it was kind of a sad moment, really. It really confirmed for Diana too that everything she'd suspected was indeed true.
Wow. And this wasn't post-wedding either, was it? This was pre-wedding.
Well, the letters were post-wedding.
Right.
The debate is always that who jumped first? Who jumped out of the marriage first? Was it Prince Charles or was it Princess Diana? I always feel that, you know, Prince Charles never really stopped loving Camilla. He always had a suite of rooms in his heart for her. And the testimony is in the developments. I mean, they've been very happily married for 12 years, and good for them.
The reason I mentioned, was it pre or post? I'm saying that Diana's feeling that the affair existed was pre-wedding. For example.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, she said to me she felt like a lamb to the slaughter. She felt that she'd been picked out, this kind of, you know, Anglo-Saxon, aristocratic, virgin bride for Prince Charles.
Mm.
And that, as he said, whatever love means, in the engagement, he didn't seem particularly enthusiastic. I estimated that they met about 27 times before he asked her to marry him inappropriately, I think, the nursery at Windsor Castle.
Mm.
And all the way through the courtship, and it was a kind of an odd courtship because every time Diana met Charles, it wasn't alone. It was always with Camilla or some other friend.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So it was like she was always being vetting. And the problem is, she was so naive. She was 19. She'd never had a boyfriend. She'd never, you know, she wasn't some sassy teenager. She was a very naive young girl. And she came into this kind of labyrinthine world, not really knowing what to expect, and just, you know, obviously half in love with the image of Prince Charles and half in love with the man.
The children obviously were very important in her life, and there's a particularly poignant moment which you talk about where William was 3 years old and said to Diana that she was the most selfish woman he'd ever met. This is a three-year-old, and then explained that he'd often heard his father saying that.
Yeah, it's come out in the revised tape,
yeah.
Actually, that he said that to her, and she was kind of taken aback, and she said, "Well, what? Who told you that?" I said, "Well, Papa." So obviously, you know, the boys picked up all this tension and animosity between the parents, and I think that's why we're seeing Harry, you know, talking about his own feelings in a way that shows you that they've suffered quite a lot.
Yes. Was there any conversation later on, after Diana's death, between yourself, William, or Harry?
No. They were struggling to come to terms with, you know, life not only without Diana, but whether they actually wanted to be in the monarchy.
Yeah. Yes.
I think both of them were... severe doubts about whether they wanted to continue.
Yeah, I mean, that came out only recently, didn't it? Last week in an interview, they're saying that nobody actually wanted to take on the role of the monarchy in the future.
Well, I mean, when you actually look at it, I mean, you know, George VI, the great-grandfather, he didn't want to do it. Edward VIII, he abdicated.
Yes.
The Queen, she and Prince Philip were enjoying life as a naval officer in Malta. So, you know, it's an onerous task, and that's why I think everybody has so much respect for the Queen, for the way that she's handled the job for the last 60-odd years.
No, absolutely. So I guess a final question for you, Andrew, before I let you go. Would you do it again? if you were starting all this again, knowing what you know now, with the furore that it caused, would you do it again?
Not a moment's doubt, because if I didn't do it, somebody else would have done it.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm very proud of Diana, her true story. I'm very proud of and very privileged to have been given a window into Diana's heart, into her soul. And I hope that I've reflected her feelings in the book. And, you know, the book started life as 150 pages. It's now 450 because,
wow.
You know, it's now all everything that's happened since, and the legacy, and obviously what she had to say for herself.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat again after 25 years. I don't think that must be a first for me, that, actually.
Let's do it. We'll do it in another 25.
Yes, my brain may be not quite so sharp in 25 years. Andrew, a pleasure to talk to you, sir. Really appreciate your time. All the best.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.